Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces Podcast. My name happens to be Scroobius Pip, and this is episode 179 of the Distraction Pieces Podcast. And the guest this week is the wonderful Rick Edwards, handsome man. It's a great episode. You're going to enjoy this. I'm going to try and keep the intro short because I keep doing really long intros. But yeah, you're going to enjoy this. There's a lot of cool stuff that we talk about. It's a real nerd out moment. In the podcast, I mention my Distraction Pieces book, which is a book. I'd explain it. I've not explained it in a bit. It's not just outtakes from the podcast. The way we did it, we set chapters that are topics that have been discussed a lot. So, for example, there's a chapter on mental health, and then there'll be a load of segments from the podcast where people are discussing mental health. There's a chapter on the creative process, and there'll be a load of different snippets from where people have discussed the creative process. And, you know, I've put introductions on each chapter and loads of extra information. There's a chapter on how to podcast and tips for starting up a podcast. I have people ask that all the time, and there's a cool section on that in there. So yeah, the book's worth a look, and it's available at speechdevelopmentrecords.com, and you can buy it signed. We've got quite a few in stock, I think, but it's Christmas, so they're flying out. I'm not going to be able to stock up any more before the new year, so if you think that could be a cool thing for Christmas, then swoop while you can. But I recommend the science-ish book that we talk about in this podcast. It's not available from speechdevelopmentrecords.com, but it's a blooming good book. So you'll hear more about that now. So let's just go straight into it. This is Rick Edwards on episode 100. I'll be back at the end to give you some more information. If you enjoyed this podcast, other podcasters I've had, I guess. I've had Adam Buxton, Richard Herring, Ian Lee, Jeff Lloyd, loads of good people who've got cool podcasts. Sophie Hagen, Josie Long and Robin Ince. I've had loads of good guests who've also got their own podcast that you can go off on tangents on, as you will do after hearing this chat with Rick Edwards. This is episode 179. Enjoy. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. Right, I'm joined today by Rick Edwards. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thanks, mate. How are you?
I'm good. We've kind of... I seem to say this every other episode now, but I think it's because it's been going for 3 years. We've talked about sitting down and having a chat for ages now, and it's happened. So
almost whenever I bump into you. I should come on your podcast bit.
Yeah, we should do that, and then it never happens. But I'm glad it's happening now. Yeah. So how are you? Are you nice and busy?
I am. I am pretty busy, actually. And I think I'm one of these classic people where when I'm busy, I complain about it. It's just like, I just want some time. I just need some space to just be.
Yeah.
And then as soon as I'm not busy, I'll enjoy it for about 2 hours. And then I'll get the panic. I'll be like, why aren't I busy? I need to be busy.
It turns out days are really long, aren't they?
They're so long.
So if you've got nothing to do, you're suddenly like, oh, yeah, this is a lot of hours.
I can only stroke the cat for half an hour at a time, really.
And that's his rule.
Yeah. She's absolutely adamant. It can't be longer than that. That's enough. Gonna lose her fur. But yeah, I'd reduce days down to sort of 8 hours.
Yeah.
There's no need. I mean, 24. Come on, guys.
It's a lot. And then, it's exhausting. I mean, I'm jumping straight in now, but we'll go all over the place, but one of the things we're going to talk about is your new book.
Yes.
And the podcast that it comes from.
Yeah.
Science-ish. And yes. I love the idea of it and the concept of it all. I think it's fascinating. For people who don't know, the podcast, it's you and Dr. Michael Brooks, and it's the science behind popular movies and kind of looking at how sci-fi does, in a lot of ways, it leads innovation in itself, because it will just have the ideas out of the realms, and that can kind of push people in that direction.
I mean absolutely, it's very interesting when you speak to like the guys who work at NASA in the jet propulsion lab. So they're the guys who are looking at how do we travel on really, really fast spaceships. It's quite cool. And they're really open about the fact that they look to sci-fi for inspiration. So they look at Star Trek and they're like, warp drives. How are they saying they'd work then? And then they go away and they work the ideas up and they get stuff out of it.
Yeah.
And then you look at... So Interstellar's a really good example. So Interstellar's an incredible film in many ways.
Yeah.
And Christopher Nolan...
I loved it, and everyone more intelligent than me seemed to hate it. So that's why it was a fascinating one. It's not one I've got to on the in the book yet.
Why did they hate it?
Just arguing over some of the science of it. So that's why it's an intriguing one to me of which bits aren't right and which bits... I loved it. I wasn't to have that conversation with these people
because I think the science is pretty good. I mean, obviously, there's some stuff that's a little bit hokey, but it's,
it has to take a leap.
But you accept that. Like, yeah, it's a film. Completely. It's not a documentary, just in case you were wondering. So Christopher Nolan was really keen that he rendered the image of the black hole, Gargantua, as accurately as possible.
Right.
And no one had really done it. So he went to this guy, Kip Thorne, who's one of the most eminent kind of scientists working in the field of black holes. And Kip Thorne actually wrote the first draft of the script, interestingly.
Wow.
And he said to him, okay, I want to make this black hole look like a black hole would look.
Yeah.
And so Kip Thorne said, no problem, and gave all of the equations, all of the black hole equations, to Christopher Nolan's VFX team. And the VFX team have got this, you know, incredible facility. And they plugged all the equations in, and then it produced this image of Gargantua that you see in the film, which is a really stunning image anyway. But the scientists, when they looked at it, were like, wow, because they don't have the facilities available to them to do that kind of image rendering.
Yeah, of course.
And so it's the first time they'd really seen a black hole as the equations kind of predict. And they were looking at it, and they were like, oh, God, it's extraordinary. And then they notice these little sort of disturbances kind of on the fringe. They're like, oh, what are these? What are these little bits? And the VFX guy's just like, well, we've got no idea. Like, we've just plugged in your equations, and this is what's come out. And the scientists were like, they'd never thought about it, but yeah, these little disturbances would exist. And they went away and they wrote a paper that got published in a proper science journal, off the back of the work that they did in the film. I think it's the first time that that's ever happened, that a film has given rise to a science paper.
Yeah.
But it's kind of, so that's like an extreme... A film
essentially based on a science paper has been able to then inform the further study of that. That's amazing.
Exactly. And that's, you know, that is a kind of quite extreme example. But I think what films do amazingly is open up conversations that are important conversations to have about sort of where we're going.
Yeah.
Because a lot of this science is just sort of rumbling away in the background, and you don't necessarily know the details of it. But I think it's fair to say that we're all interested in, you know, the direction that artificial intelligence is taking, 100%. Or the direction that genetic engineering is taking, or whether it would be possible to, you know, if we've made a species go extinct, whether we'd be able to bring it back or not.
Yeah.
These are all questions that I think we should be talking about. And films, you know, so you watch a film like Ex Machina, and I defy anyone to come out of that and not be asking questions about consciousness and could a machine ever feel anything and all that kind of stuff. And without
It's okay to fancy a machine.
Yeah.
A proper fancy machine.
And the answer is yes, it is. It is absolutely fine. but it's the thing is about films, you don't watch them thinking, I'm learning something about science here, or someone is asking me to ask questions about science. They just arise.
But they happen, and that's what's great. I spoke about this recently with a Will Poulter. About Detroit, because the fact is there's, and sorry for any listeners who I'm repeating myself, the fact is there's a certain kind of person who's going to go and watch a documentary about the riots in Detroit, the police issues and all that. And there's also a certain amount of people who aren't, but would go and see a drama about that kind of thing. So it does open those. Again, it doesn't have to be absolutely factually accurate in sci-fi and things like that. But if it's putting those questions out there that you wouldn't normally ask, then that's got to be a positive thing.
I think exactly that. I think that, you know, in terms of science, if you look at science programming, you look at what the BBC do, they do a certain type of science show for a certain type of person really, really well.
Yeah.
But you're not going to watch a show about science if you don't think you're interested in it.
Yeah.
Whereas you are going to go and see the new Christopher Nolan film.
Yeah.
For example.
Completely.
And so I think it's really... I think they're kind of an invaluable tool for getting people thinking about this stuff. And sort of by stealth. And I think it's a shame that sometimes scientists don't recognise that. And there are some scientists who kind of all rail against, you know, depictions of science and scientific advance in films. Because they're like, well, this is not really what it's like. You're like, well, that doesn't really matter. Like, but use a bit of imagination.
And again, that's exactly it. It's the beauty that it's often getting angry about stuff that they don't know the answer to either. If you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The birth of science is often referred to as the dawn of ignorance. And science, the beauty of science is it was more about admitting what we don't know than what we do know, and no longer having the excuse of we don't understand that, therefore divinity.
Yeah, yeah.
God
yeah.
made it. It's going, right, we don't understand that, so we need to try and figure it out. And that was the beauty of science coming about and being part of our consciousness. And that's the beauty of sci-fi, right? Of going, right, we don't understand that. That's probably not how it's going to turn out, but it's interesting.
Yeah, but and also that. It might do.
Yeah.
We just don't know. I think it's really, there's a kind of, I don't really want to say arrogance, there's a confidence that science is often sort of portrayed as having, whereby right now we think we know everything.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, we've got all this stuff.
Which is literally the opposite of what it's meant to be. The point is meant to be the opposite. Yeah,
and
I completely agree.
You just have to think about, like, 200 years ago, people would have said the same thing. Would have gone, do you know what? I think we've sussed most of this, actually.
100%.
And now we look back and go, wow, that's none of that's really right.
But look and how so little we knew.
Yeah, and you assume that in 200 years' time, it's probably going to be quite similar. I was saying the other day, it's a bit like you kind of, like science investigation is you're sort of going down a corridor and then you kind of pull back a curtain and there's an answer. You're like, amazing. But then it's realizing there's another curtain behind that. And then you pull back that curtain. You're like, oh, another answer. Different to that one. Yeah. And there's another curtain. And it's just loads of curtains.
Yeah.
And we don't know. We'll probably never get to a point where you just, you finish. And you go, this is the ultimate. And it's kind of quite important to remember that. Like, we don't have all the answers.
And
that's far from it.
That's great, because that was one that really struck me and moved me in the Ex Machina chapter, is the discussion about artificial intelligence. Is it possible for it to achieve a higher intelligence than human intelligence? And all the discussion there was, well, we can't really see how that could work, or this or that. It's like, well, that's because we've got human intelligence, right? That's our limit. Of course we can't see. I like that this conclusion in the book is we don't know, but of course we couldn't know, because otherwise we would achieve intelligence higher than human intelligence. We've got a limit there, and that's kind of...
We have a ceiling of our...
Yeah, exactly, and it's what I liked, because it's what made me... It summed up the power of sci-fi in that respect of... Well, some of the ideas that are going to be right are going to have to come from artists and people without the limitation of logic, because they're not going to be logical. A scientist can only go a very logical route, and some things, as you said, we're going to have things slightly wrong, or there's going to be stuff you wouldn't even consider because you're like, well, that's not possible. And then it turns out it is, whereas a director will go, hoverboards?
Yeah.
And you'll go, yeah, definitely, that sounds awesome.
100%, yeah.
on board with that. That's fantastic. And that is where it kind of, I said it then informs each other with, I mean, Star Trek and their communication systems and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Preceded mobile phones, really. Yeah. That was something that must have lent to it and made us go, right, well, that's how we should communicate then.
But there's documented stuff about the classic flip phone.
Yeah.
Who made it? Was it Nokia or was it Sony? I can't remember who made it.
Probably Nokia, right?
Probably Nokia. They were doing great business back in the day, weren't they?
They're killing it.
Absolutely. Where have they got? Poor guys. Hello, Nokia, if you're listening. Hope you're okay. but yeah, their flip phone was based on the Star Trek communicator.
Yeah.
Because I just thought it looked cool.
Yeah. And again, there's so much stuff that you just can't predict. And there's two points there, I'd say, so Nokia turned up. And prior to mobile phones, the phone was that thing in the corner of your room.
Yeah.
When Nokia came about, the biggest game in the world was Snake. Because everyone had it on their phone. Who was sitting there with a games console going, the thing that's going to be the biggest one of these is on that thing in the corner. But then equally, who was sitting there with an SLR amazing camera and going, you're not going to need these anymore soon. They're going to be on that thing in the corner of the room. That thing, or literally, I happen to be pointing at the phone on the floor there. No one would have predicted that, but
that phone's not even plugged in. Yeah, it's heartbreaking, exactly. Actually.
The biggest producer of cameras now is Apple.
Yeah.
Because of, and it was Nokia for a while. They took over from Canon and all these others because everyone had a lens in their phone. The biggest producer of lenses became a phone company. So it is these things that you couldn't predict. It's ridiculous to even consider you'd predict that.
Yeah, but the place you would look if you wanted those predictions is sci-fi. Like, you go to a Philip K. Dick novel or novella.
Yeah.
He'll have some stuff in there, and you're like, oh, wow. Yeah. Wow. Because there's a sort of creativity, and like you say, not restricted by the kind of, almost by the realms of what is possible now.
Yeah.
That's the whole point, isn't it? And I mean, in fairness, there is a real, I think, creativity within science, because if you're working at the frontiers of science, almost by definition you're doing something that is new.
Yeah,
that you have to be. You have to be thinking, right? and you know, like, okay, what's a totally different approach to this problem?
Yeah,
and then just sitting there and trying to come up with one
that
no one's ever done before, which is itself as creative as it gets. But that isn't to say that they're the only people who can create interesting, novel, valid ideas about sort of science and where science can go and where we as people can go with it.
Yeah, of course. One of the things I enjoyed about the podcast is, obviously, it is you and Dr. Michael Brooks, but you go off to talk to specialists in the areas of what you're addressing. And that's kind of, that's got to be key to kind of, because it's foolish to think that two people, part of the problem, I think, with podcasts, and I'm guilty of it, is that it'll often be uninformed people speaking on a subject for an hour.
Yeah.
When you could talk to someone who knows what they're talking about for 10 minutes and get more.
And
that's
more.
What you guys do. You go into...
You
do debate it amongst yourselves, and that's valid because that's more, as we said, it's more relatable for other people who aren't scientists to have that discussion. But you do go and talk to people who actually know what they're talking about as well.
Yeah, because you've sort of got to. Otherwise, it is just two blokes doing that.
Yeah.
Someone, I did a podcast, a politics podcast a while back with a politics professor, and he said this thing that really resonated with me. Because I was saying, okay, I'd like you to talk about this and this and this and this and this and this.
Yeah.
And he's like, okay, I can talk about that and that and that and that and that because that's my area. Those other things, I can talk about them, but I don't really, they're not really my field of expertise. It will just be me saying, prefixing everything with, I reckon.
Yeah.
And if you listen out for, I reckon, it's a real indicator of someone who's about to say something they don't know anything about. And there's some TV shows, like, I don't know if you've ever watched, I really like it. I go on The Right Stuff sometimes.
Yeah.
And The Right Stuff is basically a show that should be called We Reckon.
Yeah.
Because it's like Matthew Wright, he's very well informed.
Yeah.
And then you just have a panel of people who are being asked to talk about whatever the news throws up at them with no expertise. And so you can be, I'll be on there to talk about like my quiz show.
Yeah.
And then there'll be a story in the paper about, you know, the people saying there's a link between, you know, autism and vaccination. And they'll just go, what do you reckon? And you just go, well, I reckon. And then you just have to start. And you have to say something.
Yeah, you're there.
It really makes me laugh because as soon as this guy had said that to me, you see it everywhere.
Yeah,
you see so many I reckons.
It's a weird one because I mean, the podcast is my own thing, but I've never felt I would be the right person to be a presenter and stuff like that. Therefore, I've never had that need to just go on things to be there. Needs to get my profile up in that way.
Yeah, yeah.
And it means I've turned down Newsnight and Question Time numerous times because they've said, oh, we'd like to come on, and my label will be like, oh, we've got a new album out, this. And then I'll have the phone call with them and they'll say, oh, what we're going to talk about. And I'll generally be like, there's got to be someone better than me to discuss that, isn't there, really?
Yeah.
I can give an opinion. But again, it's exactly that. It's not going to be any real worth or value. I'll say it in my voice, which is unique to me.
Yeah.
But that doesn't help. Other than that, that's not a great selling point, surely. And even a few news podcasts recently, again, it's been exactly that. I've been like, well, I think if you know what you're discussing in advance, think you can get someone better than, like, someone more qualified. It's different if it is, oh, we're just having a chat, here's what's come up. But if they're like, here's what we're going to discuss, are you up for it? And I'm like, well, I don't know anything about that.
I mean, I'm sort of up for it, but I don't know very much about it.
I mean, I'll definitely watch.
I could, but
I'm probably better suited to watch this because I don't know anything about it.
I learn from it. You are very rare. And I think an awful lot of people are just going, I reckon I'll have a go at that.
I've discussed this, the first person on the podcast. Politics is also something that's been huge to you in recent years. But the first person on the podcast was a Russell Brand.
Yeah.
And one of the first things I kind of put to him was that he hadn't prepared for that initial interview he did with Paxman or whoever it was, where he kind of said, don't vote, or whatever else, because it's like, the don't vote is a valid view and opinion if you've got everything, your opinions to back it up and this and that. Whereas if it's just, oh, they're all the same, it's like, well, they're not all the same, because the BNP are very different.
They'd love you to believe that,
and,
by the way.
And things like that. So, but that was it. It was kind of, and Russell himself said then, he was like, I wasn't prepared for the discussion that we had. I had a rough idea of what I believe, but I wasn't prepared to nail it down. And the thing I love about Russell is he then spent years learning that and nailing it down and knuckling it down. So he did have a valid opinion of you and could defend stuff. And he could go back and say, you know what, I was wrong there, but I'm a comedian.
Yeah.
You know, I'm learning now and I'm pushing in that direction. But again, I think that's a key thing to have that kind of preparation, I guess.
Yeah, and he's got the wherewithal to see where the gaps are, and to see that it was necessary for him to go away and do the work.
Or to see the damage he could do or has done, and then correct that and do the work.
Yeah. But I'm not sure, again, that is what most people do. But to go back to your point, we've been really lucky in that we weren't quite sure how the sort of the scientific community would react to the podcast, in all honesty, because it's slightly less, I think a lot of science programming tends to be quite reverential and almost erring on a side of kind of sycophantic and everything's amazing and wonderful, and the podcast isn't really like that. It's a bit chattier and we'll have a bit of fun with it, and like if we think an idea is nonsense then we'll probably say it.
and we're
slightly concerned that scientists would rail against that, but actually they really like it because there's not really anything else out there that's doing that like that. We're very lucky in that we have scientists sort of get in touch and go, oh, if you ever want to talk about this, I'll be up for coming on, which is really lovely. Because you're kind of doing something right when people are saying, oh, I'd like to do that.
I'm up for that. It makes it all more accessible. And again, the application of science in regards to a film you like.
Yeah.
It's far more easier to understand and interesting than just, oh, by the way, here's this. It's like, well, I don't know what that... I've got no a frame of reference for that.
Well, it's exactly the thing we were saying before. Like, you were watching Interstellar, you might not think, oh, I'd love to have a lecture about black hole science.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Because that sounds off-putting.
Yeah, yeah, that sounds like an unpleasant evening.
And difficult.
I really enjoy the book, and I like it because this is going to sound odd now, but when I was first approached to do a book based on my podcast, I was kind of not that interested because it was going to be just annotating it and typing it up. It's like, well, the podcasts exist, and listening's easier than reading.
Yeah,
so why would we go that route? Yeah. It seems like we're making it tougher, but we found a way to do it that it added something. It wasn't just these annotations. We divided it into chapters on topics, so you've got numerous different sections on mental health, you've got numerous different views on the music industry or things like that. And that's what I liked about this, was again, it's another route. There is a certain amount of people, and not people listening here because we're on a podcast, but there's a certain amount of people who don't know what a podcast is. I mean, that's a big jump scientifically for them.
Yeah.
But a book like this, I mean, I'll do the hard work now, but this is a perfect Christmas type thing because it's that kind of...
Thank you. Thank you very much.
it's that kind of, right, you can just just pick up. And the way I've been reading it is just going through to the films I've jumped out and go, oh, I want to know about that. And it is written sequentially, because there's been a few bits where it's like, as we discussed in this one, I'm like,
yeah,
all right, I'll go back to that one next and read that. But that's a good thing. But yeah, I liked it because it feels like, even if you've heard all of the podcast, it adds something. It's taking a fresh look at it. It's breaking it down in front of you in black and white so you can have some diagrams and stuff like that. And
it's slightly easier to digest some of the concept. I know when I read science books, sometimes I'll need to read a paragraph 3 or 4 times until I've got it.
Completely.
And it's harder to... I mean, I suppose you could do that with a podcast and repeatedly listen to the same bit, but it might be a bit weird. But the thing that we really noticed, actually, with the book is, and you'll know this, on a podcast, you can get away with bits where we're chatting and I'll ask Michael something and he'll just go, I don't know, really. And then you can move on. And it's fine on a podcast. Can't do that in a book.
No.
Absolutely can't do it. You've got to tie up those loose ends. So there's a lot, I guess there's just a lot more kind of detail and conclusion in the book, because you can't be vague in a book.
The amount of in the annotation and that of the bits that are sections from my podcast are the amount of yeahs and amazings that we just edited out, because that's not added much. But I'm genuinely excited in conversations. I'm like that in real life. I'm like, oh, that's awesome. It's like, just shut up and let the person speak. So it's an interesting one. And I want to kind of, this is probably boring for you as you've discussed them on the podcast and in the book, but there's a few I wanted to kind of, I've been excited to talk about and I really enjoyed. And Ex Machina's a good place to start, because one of the bits that got me in there was talking about artificial intelligence. And again, a lot of science will be pushed forward. I mean, you mentioned how a paper was written off the back of Interstellar and the fact that they had technology that NASA didn't necessarily have. Industry is always going to have more funding than science.
Yeah.
Science is something that often sits on the back burner, and you can sit in a lab, wherever your pen, your paper, and figure it out yourself.
Hope you've got some funding coming. Yeah.
But the military industry is the opposite of that. It's something, there's a lot of money. And one of the things I found interesting was the drones with artificial intelligence, and the kind of interesting and valid argument that they're potentially, the computers are better equipped for modern warfare. So the thing was that they've got drones that could launch missiles of their own accord at the moment and currently aren't using them.
But the
argument put there by some people is that, a chief having to make that decision in a split second can't run through as many options and the risks, the threat and the results as a computer can. So it may be better equipped. And that was just a fascinating and scary thing. Because in general, I'd be like, no, not at all. But putting it like that, it's like, well, yeah, what if we can make someone that can make better decisions than us, then surely warfare is the ultimate one to make the better decision.
Yeah, so it's a real kind of ethical and moral minefield, isn't it? Because, the missiles that we have, and the British military have them at the moment, I think they're called Brimstone missiles, and they effectively have two modes, and the mode that we choose to use them in is called, it's called human in the loop, and it just means that it will never fire without human say so.
Yeah.
But you could flip it to...
Are you good with me?
Yeah. I'm just going to take this village out, I think. And you go for that. but you could have it in a mode where it just comes back and goes, I took that village out.
Yeah.
Is that cool? Actually, it probably wouldn't even bother asking me, so I did that.
Yeah.
And the technology, absolutely exists. And we it's interesting to think about why we are choosing not to use it in its fully autonomous mode at the moment. And I think it's because we can't quite square it off with something about us. Like, we feel like we need to make those decisions because they're so big. Having said that, in the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea, there are entirely autonomous sort of anti-missile weapons.
Right. Yeah.
The Iron Dome in over Israel is entirely autonomous. So it's making its own. So if it sees something, it thinks it's a missile, it takes it out. There's no human in the loop there. So these things generally tend to be defensive.
Yeah. It makes more. It's easier to to get right with your conscience if it's stopping an attack rather than
actively choosing a target. But I think the interesting comparison is, so in medicine, artificial intelligence is being used to look at scans. So let's say you're looking for certain types of cancer, and on its own, the artificial intelligence is pretty good. But then on its own, a human doctor is also pretty good.
Yeah.
Together, their success rate is statistically significantly better.
Wow.
So working together. So if you have an AI saying, well, these are areas of interest, this could be, this could be, this could be, and then a doctor then casting his or her eye over it and saying, ah, yeah, all right, that one.
Mm.
They will, the success rate is incredibly high. And so I think that is probably the idea of keeping a human in the loop with weapons as well. The idea that together
it can do it.
You know, because there's a sort of, there's a human experience element that we think might be difficult to teach a computer teach an artificial intelligence. Because the doctor will have just had years and years and seen so many subtleties and nuance within, you know, spotting like cancerous cells or whatever, that it's hard to then translate for the artificial intelligence. But really interestingly, and this was an announcement that was made last week by DeepMind, who are Google's AI team, who are sort of at the forefront of AI research. And interestingly, going back to what you were saying about there always being more money in business, they just buy everyone up. So if you're absolutely killing it in the public sector, like working at a university in AI, the chances are DeepMind will come knocking.
Amazing.
And they've got quite a lot of money. So
are they the ones
who
have made the AI that's playing numerous different kinds of games?
So, exactly. So they made this machine called AlphaGo.
Yeah, that's right.
And Go is this Chinese 16x16 square Chinese board game.
Yeah.
And it's always been held up as the one that computers will struggle with because there's so much intuition. So when you talk to the world's best Go players, they can't really tell you why they make certain moves because they go with feeling and hunch, and it just, and looking at the way the board is, I think this is, but they can't explain it. And so we'd always assumed if you can't explain it, then you're never going to be able to, you can't teach a computer to have intuition.
Yeah.
However, they came up with AlphaGo. AlphaGo played the world number one, beat him convincingly. It's kind of a black box system in that you can't then ask AlphaGo why it's made moves. Yeah. It's using apparently some form of intuition.
And that's what I found fascinating and scary was they couldn't then.
Yeah, you can't say to it, "Hang on, why did you this move 37 here?"
And that's it. Essentially, again, I'm telling you stuff from your own book here, but it's handy for the people listening. But the way it kind of did that was they left it to play itself 1,000 times or something, so it could then analyse millions of different moves within those 1,000 games or whatever. And
so what it's done is it's played itself millions of times, but also it's had all of the information that we have about every recorded Go game at its disposal. So you give it all of that. So effectively you give it the human experience of playing Go.
Yeah.
It processes all of that and then it plays itself millions of times. And then it gets to a position where it can beat the world's best Go players. And now human Go players are trying to learn from the way that it plays Go. The announcement that Google DeepMind made last week is that they've come up with a new AlphaGo. I don't know if it's called AlphaGo 2. It might be. And
AlphaGo.
And it's yes, exactly. Yeah, it's a good name. and it has it's beaten the old AlphaGo 100-0.
Oh wow!
Which is fairly sort of conclusive.
Yeah.
But what's sort of terrifying about it is that they gave it none of the human experience information.
Right.
So it has. So all they did is they said, This is how you play Go. And then it has gone off and from first principles learned how to play it. And it's better than the one that did it with human experience. And that's the first time it's been a kind of closed system.
Yeah.
So we've always thought that the big advantage we have is human experience.
Yeah.
And this is the first example where a computer that has none of that has just figured out a way to be better.
Yeah.
And it's quite a subtle distinction. in some senses. And the announcement didn't get that much attention, but I read it and was like, oh,
it's a big deal.
God.
It's doing it, without our input.
And that's it. No real input from us. It's just gone off and done it.
It's something that comes up a few times, is the kind of the fear of the development and speed of or the potential, or the limitless potential of development of AI, and how it could take over humans. It's what Ex Machina kind of goes upon, of going, right, I'm now above this. But the thing that I always kind of think on that is, well, that's evolution, right? If something comes about, digital or physical or whatever else, that is more equipped than humans, then our day will come, right? That's kind of how evolution works.
It's absolutely...
And we've wiped out a lot of creatures that aren't as intelligent as us.
We most certainly have. and you're absolutely spot on. It's an unusual form of evolution, only in the sense that it would have been created by another species, i.e. us.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, that is how evolution works. And there's some really interesting... In the Alien chapter, we talk about this. So there's a guy called Seth Shostak who runs SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And he thinks that obviously we've had no contact with aliens, as yet no sign of any life out there. But we think, just the numbers tell us that there is going to be life out there.
Yeah.
And he thinks the most likely life we will come across will be digital or machine.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he thinks there will come a point where the smartest biological entity will realise that a more efficient way of being, or it will develop artificial intelligence.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
yeah,
then that artificial intelligence will supersede the biological.
Yeah.
Because, biology is quite weak. Biology is really vulnerable, easily destroyed.
It's not the best system.
Doesn't last for very long. Whereas, so you look at it and you go, well, it's just too far to get across the universe.
Yeah.
Like, because it just take, literally millennia to get anywhere interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, that's not quite true. It wouldn't take that long. But it would take a long time.
Yeah.
Longer than a biological entity could last.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're a computer, effectively, then you can just sit and you just turn yourself off.
Yeah.
And then wake me up, literally wake me up when we get there.
Yeah,
and it's
yeah,
not a problem.
In a million years.
Yeah, 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 wake me up in a million years and we'll say hello.
It's I mean, that goes on nicely. I really enjoyed the chapter on The Martian, because again, it's space exploration is fascinating, and it's, The Martian was a great film because of it angered some scientists, but at least it used science and ideas and stuff like that.
Yeah, and I think that the science actually is pretty good in The Martian. It's based on a book by, I can't think, is he called Andrew? Andrew something, that's bad, I can't remember his name. Anyway, look it up. It's very, Andrew Weir, I think he's
Andrew
called.
Andrew Weir. Right?
And the book is really well researched.
Yeah.
Like, he's done his homework. And there's one thing that we've never really been that interested in is doing that kind of myth busting stuff.
Right.
So I think
if
you go online and look for Google a film and then 20 science mistakes, whatever.
Yeah.
There'll be plenty of that.
Of course.
People
sort
of going,
film.
Well, actually, Sandra Bullock's hair isn't moving quite right if she's in zero gravity.
Yeah.
And you kind of go, yeah. I mean, I don't care. I just don't find that stuff interesting.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And there's a bit of that about around The Martian. Like, you can, like you say, you can find stuff that people say, well, no, that storm was, would never have been that strong and blah, blah, blah. But overall, the science is great in The Martian, I think. Really good. And very, very pertinent at the moment, because we have people who are spending an enormous amount of money. Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos of Amazon, with Falcon Blue. Like, we're going to Mars.
Yeah.
We are going to Mars. And again, this is slightly that thing with, like, NASA have a certain amount of money.
Yeah.
Elon Musk basically has more money, and industry tends to do stuff more quickly.
Yeah,
than,
completely.
Than government organisations. That's just one of the ways of the world. And Musk is saying he's going to have landed something on Mars and start to, I think he said he's going to have container vessels up on Mars by 2022 or something, or 2024, which is, I mean, that's really soon, Pip.
Yeah,
you think about that. That's just really soon.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very much I don't think I would imagine we'd be on Mars in my lifetime.
No.
I just didn't. I don't know. Because the space race had kind of just settled down a bit,
yeah,
in a way. And now it's suddenly up again and being driven by commercial being driven by private money.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to say whether they're commercial interests, because how you make money out of this, at the minute, it's just incredibly costly.
Yeah, completely.
At some point, extraterrestrial mining and things like that, maybe people will make money. But still, the cost of flying spacecraft anywhere
isn't
is astronomical, pun intended. We are going to Mars. That's the thing.
And it's fascinating. And there's a lot in that chapter that breaks down the risks of it, the two or three different theories and plans, and Elon Musk's run is far more of a slow route there, but can return.
Go back and forth.
And there was another one that's kind of, we're going to put you there.
Yeah, Mars one.
That's about it. See you later.
One way trip. We did, it's very interesting, you kind of think, who on earth is signing up for that? And we did a talk at a New Scientist event, me and Michael, and we were talking about the Martian, and we said, okay, hands up, after we'd sort of gone through a lot of the stuff we're talking about, hands up, who would be up for going to Mars? Quite a few people put their hands up. And obviously, you can sort of imagine at a New Scientist event, it's not an entirely randomised sample of people, but we then said, what about if it's a one-way trip? They all kept their hands up.
Yeah.
I'm like, you're mad. Yeah. I like it, you know, but you're mad.
I was reading, and there was a lot, and I was like, that doesn't sound great, but it'd be interesting. Again, be a bit of a laugh. It'd be a good way to end. But then I got to the bit that said, so far, no one can really see a realistic way of having any animals. I was like, no, I'm not on board. Then I don't want to live in a world with no animals. I like to eat meat, but either for a food point of view, but more just... animals, just having animals about. And it was fascinating, again, we speak of that, but the fact that KFC have spent and funded a lot of money in trying to...
Grow space chickens.
And the issue is, without gravity, the egg doesn't sit in the right place, and therefore
the yolk needs to be in contact with the shell.
Yeah.
And... In zero gravity, you don't have that.
Yeah.
And then in, if you were doing it on Mars itself, obviously you have gravity, but it's much it's much weaker. So you have all sorts of problems. I think most of them are probably surmountable problems. Would be my guess. But there's some quite cavalier attitudes out there as well.
Yeah.
Like, we know that there's a lot of radiation in interstellar space, and also out in the solar system, cosmic radiation.
Yeah.
We know that radiation isn't very good for us. And, I mean, as far as I can tell, Elon Musk has basically just said, I think it'll be fine.
He doesn't give a fuck.
No, I think it's within okay limits.
Yeah.
Like, I want you to be really sure about that, actually, Elon, before I pop up there.
I mean, he's clearly a supervillain.
Well, I mean, if he isn't, it'd be a surprise. That's going to come
about. He's a billionaire scientist called Elon Musk. That's not a normal name.
That's straight from a DC comic, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
They're all just sort of like Tony Stark.
Yeah, they are.
They're all just a load of Tony Starks, I think.
And I like that about them.
I do.
And my brother was discussing some Elon Musk stuff the other day, and he gets annoyed with a lot of how people just get caught up in innovation and science just because it's fashionable. And he was pointing out the big innovations that Elon Musk is doing in cars is for them to be greener and energy efficient and electric and all this kind of thing. And also the kind of self-parking and self-driving, all those things. I hadn't thought of it until my brother pointed out, it's like, he's inventing buses.
Yeah,
he's inventing public transport. That's what that is. We want a way of getting somewhere that's greener, that we don't have to drive. It's like that's getting on a bus. You can do that now. Like, yeah, but we want it to be our own.
Yeah.
One. It's like, that's not innovation there. The big solution to save the planet that's going to cost billions and billions. It's like, if we all just got rid of our cars and got on public transport, that had solved.
Yeah, I mean, like,
that's true.
Yeah, I think
it doesn't look as nice.
It's not as shiny. Where you're like, just guys, get on the 134.
Yeah, exactly.
But I suppose the thing about it is that it depends where that technology ends up. Because if you end up in a situation where we all have our own driverless car,
yeah,
that's a madness.
Yeah.
If you end up in a situation where it's all quite fluid and there's sort of car sharing and there's just these driverless cars that go around that are,
yeah,
I mean, who they're going to be owned by is quite a big question.
Yeah.
But that we don't own, because that's one yeah. path it could go down, where you yeah. just don't own. Like, we look back in 50 years' time, you're like, what? So you used to own your own car?
Yeah.
You're mad. And so it's all, and almost like, yeah, you are sharing these utilities.
Yeah.
That's quite a good way.
Yeah.
But I don't know how you necessarily guarantee that we go down that route rather than the route of everyone just has another. Yeah. Granted, a more ecologically sound
but again,
device, but still.
As we've touched upon numerous times, that's also a very financially beneficial route, because we're all getting these new crazy expensive cars with crazy expensive batteries and so on and so forth. So that's the route it will go, because that's the more.
I'm literally
big business way
at the moment, and I was trying to work out, and it's difficult. I'm getting rid of my old car to get an electric car.
I'm at the exact same point, weirdly.
I've really been wrestling with whether that is the right thing to do, and I sort of think I think it's the best thing to do at the moment.
Yeah.
But it doesn't feel like a long-term solution. I'm slightly concerned I'm just doing it to salve my own conscience.
Yeah,
I'm just thinking, good, I've done a bit, I've got an electric car, I'm all right.
But then a bit of that's quite nice in itself. And again, it lends to all of this. I had Dale Vince of Ecotricity on the podcast a while ago.
Oh, yeah.
And he was someone who was making all this green energy as a charity type thing. As soon as he turned it into a business, it went through the roof and it skyrocketed, because again, there's far more.
Yeah.
You advance quicker in that. But I transferred all my electricity over to Ecotricity because it's all green.
Yeah.
And again, it's that thing. I was speaking to my dad about it, and he was like, I looked and it was a few quid more expensive a week or whatever. And I was like, yeah, but I now don't, in my mind, get any bills. I make a charitable donation each month, because all of Ecotricity's payments at the moment go to building more green energy that would, in theory, gradually bring your prices down and things like that.
So it's like,
I don't have that annoyance of, oh, for fuck's sake, I'm paying, or the gas bill's in. It's like, that's cool. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of, it relieves that.
I'm building a turbine. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I'm building another turbine. It's gradually going to get low. It feels to me like the difference between buying a property and renting a property.
Yeah.
When you're renting, you're just throwing away money every month, whereas with the green energy, it feels like, yeah, I'm still throwing the same amount away, but it's building up somewhere.
Something's happening. Yeah.
It's an improvement, but yeah, it's sort of
there's a really good site that I'm trying to now think what it's called. You'd really like these guys. So they run a thing called represent.me, which is a site. It's kind of like an evolution of direct democracy, really, where they just get people to sign up and you just go on and you say you have a whole host of categories and questions and you just say what you think about them. And then you come up with this kind of map of like where you stand on stuff. And then you have MPs. In theory, you have MPs on there and they can look and see what their constituents are thinking and feeling about stuff. And it's just a way of, you know, harnessing technology to further, you know, people in power's understanding of what people, their constituents in most cases, are thinking.
Yeah.
It's great. And it's totally free. They fund it they've got a tiny little website, which is called like something like Renewed. I'm gonna find it. I don't know if there's this is really annoying. I can't remember the name of it. It's a site where you just go on and incredibly, and in like 2 minutes, you type in your postcode and it changes you over to all of your power and utilities to renewables.
Yeah.
And it does, and it's so easy.
It's fantastic.
And each time that you switch, the energy company gives the website like 20 quid.
Yeah.
And that's how they run Represent. I mean, I'm like, this is perfect. What a great amazing model this is.
And that's that was something I found fascinating when switching over to renewable energy. Was I thought, oh, so is someone going to have to come round and install some stuff or do this? It's like, it's the same energy grid, mate.
Stuff.
I felt like a fucking idiot. Like when he literally said, it's the same energy grid. It just comes from us rather than from some big evil factory that's on the horizon.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, all right, okay.
But
thanks,
it also, it's like when you get your broadband changed.
Yeah.
And you're like, I have to drill another hole. We're like, no, are you an idiot?
Which does make you go, then this is the biggest scam ever. Yeah. You're all just going, oh, we're just turning a button and now you can have more. It's like, you pricks. It's my issue. And when this goes out, it might have already happened. I'm not sure. But a Black Friday is the one day of the year I close my web store because I find Black Friday offensive. Because if someone's saying that they can sell this to me for 70% off, it means they've been ripping me the fuck off for a whole year.
Yeah.
And I'm like, so last week you were telling me it cost that. Really? You can do it for 20 quid?
Yeah.
You fucking pricks. So infuriates
it's
me.
It's really extraordinary. It's extraordinary that we just accept that.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, to be honest, even just when stuff goes on sale.
Yeah.
It's the same thing.
Yeah.
Because I know, I mean, in very, unless it's a sort of, you know, like loss leaders, which are a different sort of beast, but you're still making some money.
Yeah.
When you're flogging it with 50% off.
Oh, there's a book that I've read. I can't think of his name now. I think it was by Hume. And it's one of the most frustrating books because it was a theory that this guy put forward for a way that we should run our economies before we went with capitalism or whatever else. And it's painful because we could never go to it now because of how we're all programmed. But his approach was simply that everything has a set price. So lamps are £10, for example.
Yeah.
That's how much a lamps cost.
Yeah.
Therefore, you don't have this competition of shit ones, good ones, bad ones, all this. It's kind of, and for example, like a plumber. A kitchen costs X amount per square meter.
Yeah.
And that means everyone charges the same. Therefore, if you're really good, then you'll be busy all the time. If you're not very good, then you might not be as busy all the time. But there's no kind of, I'll do it cheaper. And it's this competition of poor quality. And equally with...
Yeah, there's no race to the bottom.
With lamps as an example, they will all be of a good quality. Otherwise, your business will stop because all lamps cost £10. Therefore, if you're selling one that's noticeably shitter than all the others, it won't exist. So that theory put forward that we would always have we'd have zero a wastage because there wouldn't be this kind of, well, we'll get tons of melons in because it's cheaper to get a load. A load are going to rot, but we can sell what's left at a lower price because we bought them so cheap. And things like it remove all of that because everything would have a set price. And we wouldn't be, and again, it's something that my brother's a big fan of, and it's why he hates that some people in my family, I love a good deal. And again, he's like, no, the point should be that deals shouldn't exist. We should just, things should have a value, and we pay that for them. And it's such a hard concept to get into now, because we're so used to, 10% off.
Yeah.
And that's good. It's like, well, no,
just
there
consumers.
Shouldn't be. Completely. And we want that little bit extra, that
ravenous.
Little bit free. It's like, well... No, if we just pay for what we want and then we get it, that should be a fine interaction. It shouldn't have to be this competition of
these. I guess the problem, I suppose, is almost like aspiration, isn't it? Like people.
But that's what people. That's what was interesting because the argument there was still that if you're good, you'll be busier. Do you know what I mean? So although you'll earn the same, you'll again the plumbers. The example he gave in the chapter I was reading, you will be working all year round and you'll earn tons of money. And if you're not that good, then you'll be working half the year and not earning so much. But there is still that aspiration to be... But the aspiration becomes to be really good at something rather than to make loads of money, which is a better way of having it.
Yeah, and then the sort of corollary of being really good is you will have more money, and so that's a good thing. But I suppose I mean within our kind of consumerist mindset, we want things that are slightly better, not just
that are out of our reach.
So you kind of look and go. So with lamps, you might have a little look at a lamp in John Lewis and go, "Ooh, £400 for a lamp, but that is a nice lamp." Yeah. One day, maybe I'll be able to have that lamp, and then I really feel like I've and those kind of it's like status symbols.
Yeah, yeah.
And I guess that if everything was basically the same, or the same price,
but that's it. I think you'd essentially still have those status symbols in that. Again, a whole lot less people would be able to afford a car.
Yeah.
Because cars would just be at this price and you couldn't get to that. You couldn't have this on finance and all this other shit. It's like, no, when you're at that level, you get that. So it would be more rather
when you're making shit hot lamps.
Rather than a nice lamp, it'll be a lamp.
Yeah.
Oh, I'd love to be able to afford a lamp.
Yeah. One day. One day we'll be able to see in the evenings.
But yeah, it was certainly a fascinating one that I was like, any problem I could see in it only existed because of the route we went instead.
You know
I mean, if that is why it was a frustrating book rather than an eye-opening book. It was like, shit.
It doesn't
if
feel
we'd gone
reversible.
That way, we could have that would have been great. But now we're all money hungry and we all want stuff we can't have and we want a bigger TV and we want this because that person's got it. It's like, we could just be like, well, here's, you get what you pay for. It's value. It's good. Everything's of a high standard.
You sort of wonder whether there are places in the world still where society is run a bit like that, like where consumerism hasn't reached. Because I wonder
if it's not going to last, man, because it's just spreading out everywhere.
And then you wonder, is it just depressingly inevitable somehow
and you look towards that? You look at the enemy countries or whatever as the ones who, like North Korea or China, who control certain areas of the media and stuff like that to not let Americanisms in and all that kind of thing. It's like, that's seen as bad to us. And it is bad. They do some fucked up shit. I'm not defending that. But as an actual thing that we see that as bad, it's like, well, no, that's not necessarily bad, because there's a lot that's wrong with the way we do live our lives and the way America lives their lives and the way the societies that we've built. So an element of protecting yourselves from that is a good thing, not to the extent that they go where you have to have a picture up and all this kind of thing of your fearless leader and all this. But there are elements where you go, well, they've got a right to say, I don't want us to turn out like that, so we're going to try and stop that.
Yeah.
You know, it sounds like I'm a dictator now.
No. I know what you mean. It's kind of, it's very easy to look at isolationism and protectionism as being necessarily bad and backward.
Yeah.
But if the thing that you're resisting is no good, then it makes sense. That doesn't mean that the way that they are choosing to do things is the right way.
Completely.
But just saying that you don't just have to accept globalism.
One of my favourite points that Russell Brand made was when he was talking about different ideas of how we could run a government, and people are picking holes in it.
Yeah.
And his point was, that's fine, but it'd be fine if what we had now was perfect. If we're starting from perfect, sure, if you look at that and go, that couldn't work because this. So, all right, but the one we've got doesn't work.
Yeah.
So maybe there is some scope in going, well, this isn't a perfect idea, but let's try it out and see what we can iron out and see what we can make work. And it's a similar thing. We sit here in the West going, look at the way they're doing things. It's like, I mean, look at the way we're doing things, man. We're not necessarily in a place to be completely judgmental.
No, we're not sitting here in our kind of perfect society.
No.
Going, do you know what?
We've got it all figured out.
We've got no problems here, have we?
Exactly.
Everything's going so nicely.
Well, I mean, we're coming up to an hour, but there's a few things I wanted to get in before we wrap up.
Yeah,
and one was, having done or doing a podcast like this, does it give you extra excitement in the cinema of like a new film comes out, you're like, oh shit, that's going to be a good one to do? Because this year has been a hell of a year for sci-fi with Valerian, which I thought was a decent film, but I thought the sci-fi in it was amazing. It did some stuff that I've never even conceived. And then you've obviously got Blade Runner and Ghost in the Shell and stuff like that. Some really cool science stuff that instantly, as soon as I was getting into these, I was like, I want to hear you talk about the stuff in Valerian, where they have a dimensional goggles, which is kind of like a VR, but you put the dimensional goggles on and gloves, and within this room, for example, you're then seeing, and it, your hands are in the different dimension, and you can see in it, but you're not actually in it, but it's within the same sphere and space. It was just amazing things like that. I was like, these concepts.
Which is, and also, this stuff, again, is sort of coming from stuff that we think might be true. So, one of the biggest questions in physics is, how do you... So we've got two really good theories. We've got general relativity from good old Einstein, which describes everything that works on a massive scale.
Yeah.
And then we've got quantum theory and quantum mechanics, which describes everything that happens on a tiny, tiny, tiny scale.
Yeah.
We cannot get the two of those to work together.
Right.
We can't come up with a unified theory. The best that we have, there's a few options. The best that we have at the moment is called string theory. String theory says that everything is kind of like little vibrating strings of energy, one-dimensional, and which is sort of the kind of thing you say that, you go, what does that mean? It's impossible to explain. Yeah, like, I suspect no one really knows what that means. Yeah, you just have to sort of accept it. It sort of comes from the maths. But one of the things that comes out is for string theory to hold, there has to be 11 dimensions.
Right.
And we obviously have four. We've got our three space dimensions and time, although space and time are kind of similar. And then that means there's another seven, and we don't know where they are, but we think that they have to exist if string theory holds.
Yeah.
So the idea that at some point we would be able to access those seven dimensions by putting on some goggles, you kind of go, maybe. We have absolutely no idea how we might be able to do it, but there is you know, when you talk about other dimensions, and in Interstellar, the aliens live in the fifth dimension.
Yeah.
Fine. Like, we think that these dimensions exist. We have no idea what they're like, where they are. How to get into them,
well,
but
no way
we
to
may
conceive them.
No
as,
way to
as what
exactly
because again, if we're looking at time and space as these things, they're not things that you can go grab with your hands or look at. They're concepts in themselves, essentially. So
and we exist within our four.
Yeah,
and that's what we're limited to at the moment.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, theoretically possible if those dimensions exist that at some point we will be able to access.
Yeah,
them.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, you're absolutely right. Now, watching films, like Arrival, and people will always tell me as well, like, as soon as a film comes out, people are texting me and tweeting me, like, you've got to do this, you've got to do this. Arrival was a really big one, and we're going to do it in the next run of podcasts, actually, sort of alien language and stuff. Blade Runner, obviously, it's kind of...
unavoidable.
And... extraordinary. I loved it. I mean, it's very long, isn't it?
But, I thought it was great. I've annoyed some of my friends because I did think it was great, but I wasn't as blown away by them. And people get really frustrated about that.
I thought it was
really good. I genuinely thought it was really good, but it didn't quite have me on that. Look at this one. The look at this, it did have me because visually it's absolutely amazing.
Visually,
but yeah,
it's extraordinary.
I did feel it was quite long. I'm a fan of long films. I'm not against long films, but I felt, I don't know.
Yeah, I think I saw it after a lot of people I knew had seen it and were raving about it. And it's always difficult watching a film in that 100%. Circumstance because you kind of go in thinking, this is going to be, and then you're like, this is really good.
Yeah.
I wouldn't necessarily have been evangelizing about it in the way that everyone else seems to be. But I did. I mean, I did. I thought it was amazing. And the science is very interesting.
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
It's fascinating. One of the things I enjoyed on... I think it was when I was listening to the podcast rather than in the book, was I'm a massive comic book nerd. I was annoyed that Michael clearly isn't, as you kind of nudged towards it. I was looking forward to more nerding out, and it felt like you were on the edge of it.
I love that stuff.
But I was just... I was walking along to a table read thing for a thing that's the most pointless bits of information there. But I was
tell me
enjoying
more about this walk.
I was enjoying your complete, or both of your complete confusion and inability to comprehend something that I couldn't even. It was the invisibility thing.
Yeah.
and it was the prism idea that kind of switches time and space, so it gives invisibility for a tiny fraction of a second, but it's actually almost it's slowing down what you see or something. It was I couldn't get my head around it at all, but it was fascinating to listen to.
To other people also not understand
go,
it.
So basically this, and then go back to both of you, one of whom is a doctor, go, yeah. So what did he mean there?
Yeah,
like, obviously, when you're talking to the scientist, going, "Oh right, I see."
Yeah, and then when you're back, you have to. Yeah,
what was that? It was so tight. You're switching time and space, or you're switching which one is in front or something. So it's kind of block it. And I was like, "Wow, I don't."
It's also one of those things where I suspect there are no practical applications of what the guy was talking about. There are some interesting stuff.
Well, that's what's exciting on that front, because even that, it was like this tiny, smaller than a nanosecond of it, but they're already speeding it up and getting a little bit better on that. It's kind of like, right, that's exciting. Then the in many ways, having the concept is, or that's what science is, having the theory is the key part. Then the practical is a separate.
There's a classic sort of scientist trope, which is scientists will come up with a theory or a bit of maths and go, "We think that this is possible."
Yeah.
And then people will go, "Oh, amazing. So how will we do it?" And scientists will go, "Well, that's an engineering problem."
Yeah.
And they it's really good. It's just like they just wipe their hands of it. They're just like, "Listen, we've done our work.
Yeah.
Now just go away and, you know, no, I know we haven't got a material thin enough, but go and develop one." Saying it's possible.
I love it. Just to get to have the theory. It's like, oh, I don't have to prove it. I prove it on paper.
Yeah. Look, I have proved it.
Yeah.
I won't do it in a lab.
Did you not see page 34? I have proved it. Oh, so we can go so we can be invisible. Yes.
Yes. If you can solve the engineering problem.
I love it.
Yeah, it's funny. They're doing some quite fun stuff with invisibility at the moment with these things called metamaterials that change the path of light. And the idea is that in exactly the way that you would, so in a stream, say you put a rock in the stream and the water just parts and goes around it, and then a little bit upstream, you would never know that a rock had been there because the water's just has coalesced and it's there's no evidence of it. And what metamaterials are trying to do is bend light in the same way. So you bend around the object and then you come back together. Yeah. So and they've had,
and that's one of the ones limited that you talked success. About. I think
was that the one
with the cat? Because I was saying literally, if you're looking at the moment, you have to be in one specific point and then it works. But
yeah, it's one specific point, but more than that, they can only do it in a minute with that single wavelength of light.
Right.
So what that will mean is that you'll still be able to see the thing, but it'll be a really weird colour. So it's almost the opposite of invisibility. It's like, how can I make myself really stand out? Well, I'm bright pink. If you stand at that point.
Yeah.
But they're playing around with it. I think that currently it looks like invisibility is going to be quite difficult.
Yeah.
But there's, you know, that's just current thinking. That's what's exciting about it. Like, just because at the moment we can't figure something out, or we've come to an impasse, doesn't mean that in 2 years' time or in 2 weeks' time, someone might go, "Oh, hang on, we haven't really thought about this, have we?"
And I like it. I mean, there was a few different things that I was basically listening and reading, hoping that a lot of writers and directors are listening and reading, because there was a lot of bits of science you mentioned. I was like, they could make a great film out of that.
Yeah.
They could go somewhere really interesting with that. And it's kind of,
I think, I mean, I don't know, but I suspect that people like Christopher Nolan, that they keep an eye on science.
And that's it. He's definitely one that has said there's been a few different ones that it seems to. And
yeah, because in Inception, we did a podcast about Inception. It might have been the first one we ever did, actually. Really fascinating and kind of probably a bit flawed, but an amazing film and an amazing attempt to tackle a really complicated kind of little understood scientific area.
And broke it down in a way that was pretty much comprehensible.
Yeah,
I mean, it was that kind of, you had to so hang on, they're in that dream and then that but it, yeah. it made it understandable enough, and that was fascinating.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'll wrap things up now as people are appearing in then. So I think we're getting to our limit.
Yeah,
but
okay.
Just to tease people, in the book, you cover The Martian, A Jurassic Park, Interstellar, Planet of the Apes, Back to the Future. I don't know how I missed that. I'm going to be reading that.
Get on that bit.
28 Days Later, The Matrix, Gattaca, Ex Machina, and Alien. And in the podcast, as you said, you've covered Inception and a comic
book Minority
section,
Report.
A Minority Report.
One.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was one that, again, blew my mind because I was stunned that they are getting to a point where computers can predict a certain amount of crime and a certain amount of things like that. And
Big problems with inherent biases, I think, with that stuff. That's the big challenge that we have currently, is that...
Is it accusing a lot of black people?
Basically, yes.
Is the computer racist?
Yeah.
In which case, it's not a big difference from the system we've got now.
No,
so
it's like for like. Yeah.
Yeah. It could still be an improvement, sadly. But yeah, I said that, like, that was a fascinating one. And yeah, obviously, a lot of people, everyone listening now is a podcast fan. So I recommend the podcast, but also the book as a little Christmas, a Christmas book, along with the Distraction Pieces podcast book, which is also great for Christmas.
But of course, yeah.
Well, thank you very much for chatting. I said there's tons that we could have gone into, but I love that we're kind of giving our people stuff to go off and look at and research themselves now.
Just go and have a chat. Love it's all that. Interesting stuff. Thanks very much
Thanks,
for
mate.
Having me on, Pip. Finally.
At last.
It was worth it.
You've been listening to Scroobish Pip's Discretion Pieces.
Right, there we go. How much... I mean, I don't generally... I try not to do podcasts that are trying to sell anything in particular, but I had been reading that book and I was nerding out on it, and I know that this podcast serves as a brilliant advert for it, but the reason for that is, God, it was great. I was loving it. And I wanted to talk about it all and nerd out on it and find out more information. So yeah, check that out. Science-ish. It's worth a look. And I'll see you all next week I've not decided yet. It might be my films of the year, or it might be the vinyl special. Either way, it'll be a lovely time, and I'd love to have you along. All right. So come on down next week to the Distraction Pieces podcast. You can find us on iTunes, where you can give us a 5-star review and leave a little comment saying, oh, I liked it, but then he did a northern accent that was so rubbish. It was just unconvincing and it ruined it a bit for me. I'm still going to give it 5 stars because, you know, it's still a great podcast, but I need to leave a comment just saying that accent were rubbish. It's also available on Acast, where you can have links on that. So there would have been links to the Science-ish podcast and the Science-ish book, and probably the Distraction Pieces podcast book, no less. So check that out. Lovely time. And I'll see you all next week. Thank you for tuning in. Have a lovely week. We're getting close to Christmas, aren't we? Don't get too caught up in all the mayhem, but enjoy it. Enjoy it for what it is. Enjoy it for what it is. It's a lovely time. I love a bit of Christmas, me. People get angry about Christmas, like, oh, it's commercial, it's this, it's that. So what? You don't have to do that if you're not into that. Just enjoy it for what it is. Enjoy it for the nice food and nice atmosphere and people being a bit nicer to each other. I like it. I think it's a lovely time. I'm not religious. I don't care. I like putting on Christmas jumpers and eating baked camembert with bread. That isn't how they'd say camembert, is it? Baked camembert? Baked camembert with bread? With bread? Baked camembert with bread? This is killing people at the moment, I know it is. So yeah, and then eating lovely Christmas food. I love a chocolate Yule log. I love one. I love them. A chocolate Yule log, are you kidding me? Bloody lovely. Oh, I can't get enough. Chocolate Yule log. You can start eating them as soon as it's December. You don't have to hold off for Christmas, I'll tell you. Don't be silly. Just get your teeth into a chocolate Yule log.
If you got a beard, get it in your beard. Get it in your blooming beard. There's probably something from Harry's razors to clean it out your beard to make it not smell of chocolate Yule log. What else do I like at Christmas? I like all the little party food. I like the party food they do. I like going to Marks and Spencer's. But also, everyone thinks, oh, go to Marks and Spencer's. That's going to be best stuff. Get some stuff from Marks and Spencer's. But don't be a snob and write off Iceland or Tesco or Morrison's or Sainsbury. You know, there's loads of good ones. Asda. Don't write off Asda. There's loads of good ones. Go and have a look at what party food they do too. To have a little mixture. Sometimes the cheap crap's the best bloody stuff. So go and have a little mixture. Have loads of... just eat party food all through December. Every day's a party if you do that. You don't have to do the bit where there's all the people there on that, the rubbish bit of the party. You can just do the food bit, the good bit. So that's going to be good. Party food, chocolate Yule logs. Just enjoy Christmas, like... I went Scouse then, and I hadn't really been Scouse. I'd been more like more a broad Yorkshire accent. But now I've got a bit more Scouse like. So fucking Christmas, you know, it's the time that it's nice when it's cold. Oh, I'm losing it completely. That was a hell of an end to the podcast, wasn't it, guys? Thank you for tuning in. If you've not been put off forever, I'll see you next week. Ta ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.